Everyone, I'm going to call the meeting to order. The clerk will note the roll. There is a quorum. We have the minutes of the last meeting of February 8th before us. Representative Carlson moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? All in favor of approving the minutes, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Before we get to the agenda of the day, members, I want to make a couple of introductions. First of all, for those who were at the February 8th meeting, which wasn't everyone since it was we weren't in session, we do have a new committee administrator, Harry Kennedy. So I think a lot of you know Craig Stone took the position that Bobby Patrick used to have with the speaker. And so Harry Kennedy is our new committee administrator. Some of you who have been on the committee a long time will recognize him because he was the committee administrator for this committee when Mary Liz Holberg chaired it back in 2011 and 12. So we have an experienced committee administrator who's already telling me what I should be doing. not really. But anyway, we're glad to have Harry. He's going to do a great job. And we also have our three pages. Pages, if you would stand up, that are going to be helping us. We have Becca, Santa, and Emmett. Wave your hand. Okay, so Santa, wave your hand. All right. And Becca, wave your hand. And Emmett. All right. Welcome. We're looking forward to having you help us this session. Thanks very much. Okay, members, we've got three items on our agenda today. The first, I've wanted to have a presentation on the state's economy and some things that are going on with it for some time here. We've got the Center for the American Experiment that's going to be coming in doing that. I think that it's always good to have a little bit of contrarian viewpoint from what we're hearing in some circles. But then Representative Carlson came to me and said he felt that he wanted to have, and that it would be fair to have another group come in and maybe give a contrarian point of view to the Center for the American Experiment point of view. And so I'm going to have the North Star Policy Institute come up for a bit as well. Finally, as everyone I think knows, this whole issue of tax conformity is a really big issue that we're going to be facing this year, and we've already had two extensive hearings in the tax committee. Our Chair Davids is here and can tell you all about them offline if you're interested, and I expect we're going to have several more, but I did feel we should have a little bit of a discussion of this in Ways and Means, too, because it is something that affects the budget and is a money issue that, with us being the committee that deals with money, we should have some awareness of. So we'll take that as the last item of the day. With that, if I could call John Hinderacher forward from the Center for the American Experiment. Mr. Hinderacher, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means. I think you've got an introduction that you wanted to make, and then we'll take testimony from you or your other person up there.
Sure. Well, thank you, Chairman. I'm John Hinderacher, President of Center of the American Experiment. I want to thank you for the opportunity to be with you this morning. Our main presentation will be done by the Center's economist, John Phelan, who's with me here. John has a degree in economics from the University of London and a master's degree in economics from the London School of Economics. John, take it away.
Mr. Phelan.
Hello there. Thanks for having me today. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. I've not been in the state that long, so it's nice to come and see something a bit different. The presentation we're going to give today is, as you can see, the state of the Minnesota economy. This is an update of a paper we did in 2016. Economist called Joseph Kennedy did that year. And what we did this year was just to, primarily to take the data another year so we can add another year's data points to what we did in 2016. But also we altered the end of the paper so that we can take more of a forward look into what the prospects of Minnesota's economy might be using a framework of economic growth theory. So the first things that we're going to talk about are GDP and productivity. They probably won't need much explanation, but it's worth stressing their importance. GDP is the statistic that you hear probably most commonly cited in terms of economic well-being, and productivity in turn is absolutely vital to that. So how does Minnesota do in terms of GDP growth? Well, the chart that you can see in front of you, this shows Minnesota's GDP growth rate relative to that of the United States, generally, from 1987-88 to 2015-2016. And what you see over time, I think, is that in recent years, particularly in the last 10 years or so, GDP growth rates have not compared all that favourably, or certainly not as favourably as they used to, with the nation as a whole. And you can see that there actually seems to be some kind of a downward trend since about 2007-2008, which brings us back closer to the US national average. So the lead that we seem to have on average in the years before that, we seem to be losing that now, and we seem to be slumping down to the average. Now, one thing that you'll hear commonly said when you talk about GDP growth and that our growth is, you know, kind of slowing down to the national rate, is that this is just a product of convergence, and that economic theory says that over time, areas with lower incomes will converge, the incomes there will converge with the incomes in higher income areas. Well, over time, you know, the theory is borne out by an awful lot of evidence, and it was borne out by a lot of evidence in the United States, and there are lots of papers that talk about convergence between richer and poorer areas. So you will expect to see this happen. But the interesting thing is that this convergence has stopped. Recent economic literature shows that since about 1983, 1984, 1985, there has been no convergence whatsoever between low-income and high-income areas of the United States. There are things on our website where I've written about this research. So when we look at this here now and see that our economic growth rate is trending down towards a national level, it cannot be described as something that's happening as a result of convergence. So it's just one of those things. It's actually something that we are seeing in the data, and it's not something that's happening, you know, exogenously as a result of convergence. So what we do here is we go back to 2000, start of a new century, and we look at GDP growth in Minnesota and the United States from 2000 to 2016. And what you see is that on average, because of these lower growth rates, Minnesota's GDP has grown more slowly than the United States' GDP over that period. The takeaway perhaps from this slide is that if our GDP growth rate had matched that of the United States generally over this period, the state's GDP would be 2.5% higher than it currently is. Now, one of the things about a chart like this is that this is a percentage change from a particular point in time. So, obviously, this is very much dependent on the particular point in time that you choose. What this chart here shows you, and this is a very similar to the chart that we saw previously. The previous one used annual data. This is using quarterly data, again from the Bureau of Economic Analysis. And what this chart shows you is that if you start real GDP accumulation growth in quarter four 2007, it tells a different story to what we saw in the previous chart, just to remind you there. So as you see there, we actually lagged the national growth rate. If you look at this chart, we're actually ahead of it. So what's going on here? Well, what this is entirely a function, as I say, of the start point that you use. Now, this data series doesn't go back to 2007. It goes back to 2005. Then if you project it back to 2005 and start this data series, from where or start this chart from where the data actually starts, then you see something that's a bit closer to our chart. You see, in fact, that Minnesota's growth rate over the period that this data presents has been lower than the US average. So this goes to show that if you want to cherry pick a particular start date for a particular series, you can there's quite a lot of leeway in what you can show and what you can find. Yeah. And this, just to clarify, this chart here is something that you'll see in the handout from the North Star Policy Institute. I think it's the first chart on their handout. So, you know, if you take their chart and project the data back, then you get this chart instead. So, again, it's a question of, you know, why choose that particular start date rather than the start date of the data series. So we move on to this here, which is how Minnesota's GDP growth rate relative to the other states. Oops, sorry. Move on. So what this shows here is the percentage change in real GDP for the top 15 MSAs from 2001 to 2016. Now, we chose the 15 MSAs that had the highest GDP in 2016 because these are the states that we are, or these are the other MSAs that the Twin Cities are kind of in competition with, if you like, for you know, for jobs and for people moving in, for incomes, investment. And what you see here is that we don't actually do that well among this peer group. We actually grow below the average of these metropolitan areas. The areas that we are growing faster than are New York. We've got Chicago in there. We also have Detroit in there as well. Now, this is not to be mean to these particular areas, but we really should be setting our sights higher than doing better than Chicago and Detroit. The fact that we are towards that end of this spectrum, it's not encouraging. This here is GDP by MSA in Minnesota and the bordering states. That's the two Dakotas, Iowa and Wisconsin. It's a little difficult to see here, but what you can see on this next one, which just zeroes in on the top of that, is you can see that only Mankato of Minnesota's MSAs actually breaks into the top 10 in terms of growth. Okay. So, well, yeah, there's clearly something interesting going on in Mankato. If anybody's got any ideas, please let me know. But you'll see that generally Minnesota's MSAs haven't grown by a particularly impressive rate compared to the MSAs in neighbouring states. And as I say, again, that includes the two Dakotas, Iowa and Wisconsin. And what's interesting here is if you look at this, you'll see that whereas we have one of our MSAs in the top 10 of these this peer group, Iowa has three. Mm-hmm. Now, I said that productivity was going to be important because ultimately that's what drives everything. And this is not a controversial point. This is not really something that a lot of economists argue about. At a presentation at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis recently, the state economist, Laura Columbakidis, said that someone asked her, you know, what's the most important thing for Minnesota's economy going forwards? And she said it was to solve the productivity problem, which is what we're going to talk about now. Paul Krugman, who's perhaps not an economist that you might expect someone from our side to cite all that readily, he said that productivity is, in the long run, it's almost everything in terms of economic growth. Because what productivity is, it's taking a given set of inputs and transforming them into a larger amount of outputs. And that really is the essence of economic growth. You know, that's what it's about. It's not about working more. It's not about putting more in. It's about getting more out. And, you know, economists call that productivity. So what this chart shows you here is private sector productivity in Minnesota, 2000 to 2016. And so what this is, it's GDP divided by employment, so, you know, per worker productivity. And what you see here is that we lag the national average, and we lag it by a not inconsiderable amount. The average Minnesota worker is less productive in terms of GDP than the average US worker. And we calculated that if the average Minnesota worker was as productive as the average US worker, then GDP per each person in the US in Minnesota, their GDP per capita would be $3,500 higher in 2016 than it currently is. If you times that by four to get the, you know, some rough idea of what that might mean for a family, you start to see, you know, the stakes involved in all this in terms of people's financial well-being. Now, there's lots of different ways that you can calculate these sorts of productivity things. So that there is productivity divided by, you know, employment. If you look at this here, we've got GDP per hour worked. So this is another way that you can measure the productivity of the economy. And you see again here that goods producing productivity is in Minnesota, our goods producers are less productive than the US average. And again, you see that this is partly it's a trend that you see nationwide. You'll see that there's you know, almost no productivity growth in the US since about 2010. This is a much commented on phenomenon. There's all sorts of explanations for why this might be. But it's a phenomenon that you also see in Minnesota. And it's a particular problem here because our productivity is lower in the first place. But here we move on to service-producing productivity. Now, this is done the same way. So this is done by taking GDP and dividing it by hours worked in the service sector. And this is actually, this is more worrying, actually, because, again, you'll see that the nationwide trend here is largely flat. I mean, it's improved a little bit since 2013. But only by a small amount, and we're not really much ahead of where we were in 2010 as a nation. But as a state, Minnesota's service-producing productivity has actually deteriorated since 2010. Now, this is concerning in one respect, because a growing share, as we'll see later on, a growing share of Minnesota's jobs are actually in service-producing industries. So if we're growing jobs in these low productivity service producing sectors and not in these, not in the higher producing sectors, then that's going to impact overall state productivity, and that's going to negatively impact state GDP growth. Just to give you some idea here, you'll often hear people say, well, Minnesota has very high GDP per capita. And that's true, it does. We have a GDP per capita that's above the national average. But that's really largely a function, this is something that we'll return to, of the fact that we have a lot of people working here. You know, Minnesotans work very hard. There's a lot of Minnesotans working, and these are statistics that are still to come in the presentation. But just to give you a quick indication of what that means, is this chart here shows the top line is GDP per capita, the blue line. So that's the statistic that you'll often see reported. People often talk about, how well we do. And you'll see that this is the difference with the national rate. So you'll see that GDP per capita there, we are above the national rate. The line below is GDP per worker. And there we are below the national rate. Now, you can square this circle, and it's mildly technical, but if you've got more people working, you've got a greater amount of GDP to divide among the population. Ultimately it all comes back down to GDP per worker. And as you see there, we do badly compared to the national average. What this shows you here is what I said to you earlier on. GDP per capita and GDP per what it would be in Minnesota if it matched the national average. Like I say, we're looking at $3,500 for each person in Minnesota in 2016 if our workers were as productive as the national average. We're not talking about being particularly high productivity state here. So that brings us next on to incomes. This is obviously an important one because this is how most people experience the economy. It's what comes into their pockets and how they can afford to live their lives. Now, here is weekly earnings, all employees, Minnesota and the United States. And you'll see here, good news, that Minnesota actually is a little bit ahead of the United States. And when you think this is weekly earnings, if you add this up every year, it's a not inconsiderable amount. But one thing that the U.S. government does is it produces a series of data known as real per capita income growth. So this is personal incomes. It's a data series produced by the Bureau of Economic Analysis. And what this is, it's data that, and it's a very long data series, goes back a very long time. So it does have the virtue that you can look back, quite far into the past. And it breaks it down by several categories. Personal income can come from labor income, which is generally wages. It can come from capital income, which is kind of dividends or whatnot. Or it can come from transfer payments, such as unemployment insurance or social security, things like that. Now, what this chart here shows is the growth of real per capita income over the period 2000 to 2016. You'll see that we are about on the average for the United States here, but we are also below about two-thirds of states. So we're kind of doing okay to not quite so okay on this measure. This map here shows a similar thing for the various counties in Minnesota. You'll see that the darker the shade of blue, the greater the change in real per capita personal income is. So you do get some notion here of the geographical breakdown of these trends. You'll see that big swathe in northern Minnesota where personal income growth 2015 wasn't all that impressive. And as you move south, southwest, the growth was higher. Now, I talked a little bit about the different sources of personal income. Now, how have these changed over our period 2000 to 2016? Well, that's what this chart here shows. The red one is transfer income. The green slice is capital income, and the blue slice is labor income. Now, what this shows you is that the increase in personal income from 2000 to 2016, what components of that increase came from these different sources? And we see that, in actual fact, labor income accounted for 41% of that increase. Capital income accounted for 12% of that increase. But the main component in that increase, in the growth of that per capita personal income, was the growth in transfer income. That accounted for 47% of the growth in per capita personal income over that period. And like I say, again, that's things like unemployment insurance, social security, things like that. That's not good, by the way, because there needs to be some kind of safety net, and we need to have these things. But you cannot have a situation where the increase of these things is such a large part of the increase of people's personal incomes. This here breaks that pie chart down in a slightly different way. Again, we have the three different categories. We have labour, capital, and transfer income. And you see that the increases in this period between the United States and Minnesota. So nationwide, labour income increased by 9%, and in Minnesota it increased by 9.4% over this period. So we led the nation there. Capital income, we lagged the nation. In the US, generally, it grew by 13.3%, and in Minnesota it grew by 10.2%. But then you come to transfer incomes, and again, this is the thing I was talking about, unemployment insurance, social security, things like that. And here you see that the growth nationwide was 59.9%, and in Minnesota it was 69.1%. What this chart here shows
Excuse me, members, I'd like to, I've had a couple people raise their hands to ask questions, but I think I'd like to go through the presentation, and then we'll go back and take questions.
Okay,
thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Phelan.
This chart here shows you, and like I say, because you can, this data series, one of its great advantages is that it goes back quite a long time. So this actually goes back all the way back to 1929, and it shows personal income as a share of the source. So you see here that over time, the grey section at the top, the grey slice, that's transfer income. And you can see that over time that has grown fairly steadily from about the 1950s. It's become an increasingly large share of Minnesota's personal incomes. And there was a slight jump from about the mid-2000s onwards in that slice. Capital incomes, probably you'd say grown ever so slightly as a share, but not grown all that much. The big loser there in terms of share is labour income. Which brings us to another point. Here we see median household income for the United States and Minnesota's 2000 to 2015. This is another statistic that you often see cited. People will point to the very high personal incomes in Minnesota relative to the national level. And it's true, there you can see it there, that we have these high high levels compared to the national level. But why is that? Well, this gives you some idea, I think, this chart here. It shows the proportion of households by the number of workers. Now, in the United States generally, there are 26.8% of households that have no workers in them. In Minnesota, that figure is 23.7%. In the United States generally, there are 38.2% of households with just one worker. For Minnesota, that figure is 35.0. So on both of these, we lag the national average in terms of no workers and one worker. But then we come to households with two workers in them. The national share there is 28.4%. In Minnesota, it's 33.8%. There's a fairly significant lead there. And then we come to three or more workers per household, and the national amount or national share is 6.7%, and for Minnesota it's 7.5%. So just go back to this here. You see these high household incomes, but that's very largely a function of this, the fact that there's more people in each household working. Now, one of that's good. It's good to have people working because that boosts GDP per capita, as we talked about. But on another level, go back to the productivity thing. You know, it's great to have people working, but working is not the point. Production is the point. That's why you work. You work to produce. You don't work for the sake of it. And so this ties back into these problems of productivity that we have in Minnesota and that we're going to need to tackle in a fairly serious way going forward. So the next section that we look at is jobs. This chart here shows employment growth in the US and Minnesota over 2000 to 2016. Again, it's the sort of cumulative percentage growth. And you'll see that here in Minnesota in recent years, I mean, it kind of tacked quite closely to the national average for a very long time. But over the period of, from about 2005 onwards, there was a slight gap opens up where the national growth rate was higher than ours. We caught up and made up, and we were running about level with them until about 2013, 2014, when that the lines start to diverge again, and once again we start to lag the national growth rate. This here shows employment growth 2000 to 2016 for all the various states. You'll see that there's a black line there. That's the U.S. average. And you'll see that the Minnesota actually lagged the U.S. average over that period. You also see down the bottom states like Michigan, which are states actually lost jobs over this period. If we have a look at this here, this looks at the similar thing, the percentage change in total employment for MSAs. So you've got the blue bar there, which is the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul. And you'll see again, this is the 15 MSAs with the largest GDP in 2016. Again, these are our peers, the MSAs that the Twin Cities are competing with for investment, for jobs, for new business. And you'll see again, you know, we're some way below the average for these MSAs here, that black line. And you'll see again that some of the states that we're ahead of are Chicago and again Detroit, which is a city where the workforce actually shrank over this period. This shows you a similar data across Minnesota's counties for the period 2000 to 2015. Where you see blue on here is where total employment shrank. Where you see red is where total employment grew. And you'll see that very largely it was a function of the suburbs of the Twin Cities and that some of the areas further out, particularly towards the southeast, we actually saw the labour force shrink there. Now, I talked a little bit about how hard people in Minnesota work. And you see an element of that here, the labour force participation rate. And to some extent, this is very similar to the bar chart that we saw a little while ago with the different shares of people, numbers of people working in each household. And you'll see again here, this is another commonly cited statistic, the labour force participation rate. We do very well on this. We have an awful lot of people working, as I've said. And we consistently lead the US on this measure. But again, you know, remember that the point of this is to produce. It's not to work. We work to produce. We produce to consume. And so the idea, this is a good thing, but not in isolation. It depends on lots of other things. And when you look at this and remember this data, you have to think back to the productivity of this labour force. So while the labour force level is high, its productivity level is comparatively low. This gives you some indicator of why that might be. This is Minnesota's GVA and job growth over the period 2016. Now, GVA is just another way, it's gross value added. It's just another way of talking about gross domestic product. It's a very similar thing. And so what we do here is we look at the major industry categories from financial activities through to leisure and hospitality. And we look at the amount of GVA that each job, so it's GVA divided by the employment needs in these sectors, the amount of GVA per job that these businesses produce or these industries produce. And we rank those, as you can see, from left to right, highest to lowest. So in financial activities, each job there generated a very high level of GVA, something like $300,000. And you get down to leisure and hospitality, and the jobs there generated a very low share of GVA, relatively speaking, you know, somewhere maybe around $50,000. And what the black line here shows you, and this is the interesting thing, is that this is the black line is job growth in these sectors, percentage job growth, between 2000 and 2016. And you'll see that whereas the GVA per job number is skewed on this side, the growth number is skewed on the other side. And what that shows you is that we've had the most job growth in the lowest GVA producing sectors. So sectors like healthcare, educational services have really led, you know, our job growth. Now, this is not to denigrate these professions at all. You know, people need to do these jobs. We need people doing these jobs. But at the same time, you know, we need the people earning the high salaries and generating the large amounts of GVA in industries like mining and logging if we're going to pay for, you know, and support this tail down the other end. you know, to generate the wealth in the state and higher incomes in the state. So this is quite concerning, actually, what you see on this chart. I mean, we talk a lot about job growth, but you have to think about the types of jobs being created to a very large extent. Now, one of the new things that we did on this report was we looked at, we took a framework of economic growth theory, and we decided to look at certain indicators and look at where Minnesota might be going in the future. Now, economic growth theory, this is a chart that gives you some idea of how this breaks down. So the growth of per capita incomes, it's worth remembering, per capita incomes is what matters. You can, if you double GDP and you double the population, GDP is exactly the same and no one's really any better off. So you've got to grow per capita per capita incomes really to make people better off. And the growth of per capita income is really the sum of the growth of the participation rate, which we talked about, the labour force participation rate, the growth of capital per worker, and the growth of productivity. Jargonistically, it's often called total factor productivity, but for the purpose of this, I simplified it down to productivity. So we look at what are the prospects for each of these three things and how they feed into the prospects for the growth of per capita income. Well, this chart here shows you, this is Deeds data. This is their projection for Minnesota's labor force participation rate. Now, the problem that you have here, obviously, as baby boomers start to retire, is that the labor force participation rate is projected to fall. So if you go back to this here, you'll see that that is going to be a negative value in this sum. Now, our labor force participation rate is projected to fall until about 2035, I think, as baby boomers move out of the economy. Now, so obviously, as you see, this is a problem where this is concerned, where this sum is concerned, because it puts a negative value in there. So what do we need? What can we do about this? You know, the labor force participation rate declining. Well, one thing we need to do, and one way we can offset this, is we can have growing per capita incomes with a declining labor force participation rate if we can offset the decline in the participation rate with an increase in worker productivity. And again, I cited the state economist earlier on. This was specifically the question she was asked at the conference at the Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis. She was told, you know, what is the solution to this labor force participation rate decline? And she said productivity. And that's absolutely true. That is, you know, I can't stress enough that that's the key thing. So what you want is a productive workforce. So that means, on the one hand, it means retaining the productive workers you have and attracting productive workers from elsewhere. So how do we do on that? Well, if you think that productivity can be measured to some extent by incomes, and generally it's held that you know, that's how you do these things in economics, we can look here at the net flow of taxpayers and dependents in Minnesota by the primary by the income of the primary taxpayer. This is IRS data for 2011 to 2015, and you see that we actually have a net inflow of taxpayers who earn less than $25,000 a year. So we're attracting people on these on low incomes. And you think, you know, that these are low productivity workers. And we're actually losing workers. And this is not rich people, you know, fleeing the state. This is people earning, you know, a reasonably modest $25,000 a year. We're losing in those categories as well. Now, this is the opposite, really, of what you want to see. If you're thinking that a productive workforce is the or one of these solutions to this declining labour force participation rate, you would want to see this the other way round. So that there is a source of concern. You think, well, why is it? You know, why is this? We have some ideas. This here shows you the state local tax burdens per capita as a percentage of income. As you can see, we rank very highly on that. We are one of the more heavily taxed states in the nation. I don't think that there would be much disagreement about that. And also, you know, to go back to this, you know, we're not talking about taxes on the rich here either. Minnesota's lowest starting rate of personal income taxation is higher than the top rate in 23 other states. So we actually tax people on middle-class incomes and lower incomes quite heavily as well. So we're not just talking about, you know, fat cats here or something like that. And so we think that this is part of the answer. And you'll see here, this here is, because very often people will say, well, this is older people leaving, you know, this is snowbirds. Whenever I used to show people that chart, that's exactly what people would say to me, snowbirds, people leaving for Arizona or whatever. Well, this chart here, again from IRS data over that period, 2011 to 2015, it shows you that we are losing people in every age category. This is not just, you know, retirees fleeing the state. One of the biggest categories that we're losing is people aged under 26. You know, this is, you know, no country for young men, to coin a phrase. You know, so, again, this is a source of concern for the state. So we come back to this, and we look again at the sources of per capita income growth. Having looked at the growth of participation rate, which is set to decline, and the worrying prospects for maintaining a productive you know, workforce, we can look again at capital per worker. This is quite a tricky one, actually, because there's very little data on this. There's very little data on state capital per worker. There's an awful lot of data at the national level, but very little at the state. I've been in touch with a guy at the University in California who provided me with this data, which updates from 2015. You'll see here, this is the state capital stock divided by the worker. So that gives you the capital per worker. And you'll see here that we actually lag, once again, the national average. We have closed the gap somewhat between 2000 and 2015, but generally our workers have less capital behind them than the average American worker. Now, what drives that? Now, there's academic evidence that suggests that corporate tax rates are an element in this. And you'll see here, again, this is no surprise, I'm sure, that Minnesota has very high rates of corporate income tax. So this is not something that's going to encourage an awful lot of investment into the state, you know, capital investment or otherwise. And remember that this is one of the sums in our growth equation, and it negatively impacts it. You'll see here, this is venture capital per worker. This data set runs from 2002 to 2015. And you'll see that, this is a surprising one actually, it surprised me when I looked at these numbers. You'll see that venture capital per worker, not only do we lag the national average, but we lag the national average by an increasing amount. And that in the last few years, there's been a surge in venture capital per worker nationwide, and it just hasn't happened here. In fact, in the most recent year we have data for, it trended down. This is also borne out by what you see here, the share of new and young businesses as a share of all businesses, 2000 to 2014. We've always lagged the United States generally, and this might, again, surprise people. New and young businesses are absolutely vital because, as the old cliche goes, you know, today's small business is tomorrow's big business. It's a cliche because it's true. New and young businesses, small businesses, they generate most of the new jobs as well. So to see this is, again, a source of concern. You'll see that Minnesota has always lagged the United States as far back as its data goes, 2000, and you'll see that gap has widened over time. You know, we have actually lost ground to the nation in terms of business startups and entrepreneurialism. And that, again, is a source of concern. So this brings us to the third and final part of our growth equation, and that is the growth of productivity. Now, this is a slightly slippery phrase. Economists would often use a phrase called total factor productivity. And if I could, it's on the one hand, it's the most difficult to understand, and on the other, it's the most important to understand, because all the academic evidence suggests that economic growth is driven overwhelmingly by increases in total factor productivity. So what you have, if I had to explain it clearly, is a growth in the participation rate is a growth in the amount of labour. Growth of capital per worker is an increase in the amount of capital per worker. The growth in total factor productivity is an increase in the quality. So whereas the other two are quantity measures, this is an increase in the quality of capital per worker. So in the, there's evidence, for example, from the IMF for the US states, because again, this is not something that gets looked at the US state level very often, but the IMF took a stab a couple of years ago, and they said that it was driven by education attainment, although I think they used a fairly imperfect measure of that, and also spending on R&D, research and development. And what those things show you is that they're about improving the quality of these inputs. Not the quantity, that's the first two of these things. It's about improving the quality of the inputs that you have, your labour inputs and your capital inputs. So it's about skills. It's about human capital, as economists call it, and it's about innovation. It's about innovating new products, moving, as you see in agriculture, that they've got all these agri-tech, things like that. And a final aspect of that and a third aspect of that is entrepreneurship, which is the mixing of these various elements into the growth equation. So you can see that on the one hand, it's a slightly slippery concept. It's also a very important concept. And all the economic evidence shows that this is really where the action is in terms of economic growth. We look at Minnesota's educational achievement indicators, and they do quite well here. Minnesota's education system does quite well, but you have to be very careful of that. You have to safeguard that. You have to really protect that. And make sure that going forward that stays as being a source of strength. And then we also have R&D intensity here. Now, what this shows you is the share of research and development spending as a share of state GDP. This is data from the OECD. Now, you'll see here that at times in recent years, we've actually led the national average here. We are talking, in fairness, about fairly small numbers. But, these are sort of quite high-end research spending. So these numbers might be small, but they can be very important. And you'll see that in recent years, up until about 2009, 2010, we were leading the national average here, or the national rate of R&D spending. Since then, we've slipped back, and we are now, according to the most recent data, a little bit behind on that. We have a measure here of patents per million of population. So this is a slightly difficult one. It's some rough measure of inventiveness, I suppose, of the various of the people in the state. And what this shows you is that we do quite well on this measure, although I would be wary of taking this necessarily on entirely face value, because I think some of this may well be a factor of the facilities that certain companies have based here. So we might have head offices here where the R&D is done somewhere else, but then the patent is logged back in this state. So what we have here, to go back to our growth equation, we've looked at the growth of the participation rate, which, to summarise, that's going to fall. The labour force participation rate is set to decline, and we need to have a more productive workforce to offset that. And the signs for that are not entirely positive. We are losing, it seems, the more productive workers. The growth of capital per worker, unfortunately, we have policies that do not encourage the accumulation of capital per worker. Funny enough, there is an interesting story in manufacturing. We do quite well in manufacturing in Minnesota, but that's actually part of that is because we tax manufacturers at a lower level than we do some other businesses. And then we come to the growth of productivity. And this, again, like I say, this is a function, according to IMF research, of educational attainment and also of research and development spending. So those are areas that really need to be protected and pushed going forwards. There also is the element as well of that I talked about of entrepreneurship. And we do know that one of the obstacles to entrepreneurship is regulations. So where we have a situation where we can look at our regulations, and we see this in Washington at the moment, at the national level, where regulations are being rolled back. And I think that's, you can see in the economic growth figures, that that's having an impact. It's having a positive growth impact. And if that works at the national level, it can also work at the state level as well. So to sum all this up, Minnesota is a state with a tremendous amount of advantages. You know, it's got an awful lot going for it economically. We do very well. We live very well here. We work very hard for that. And what we need to do is to do more to turn that effort and turn that input into output. Because if we can do that, then, as I say, we can boost the GDP per capita of the residents of this state by $3,500. That was what it would have been in 2016. And for a family of three, four, that's, pretty impressive. But that, I think, gives you some idea of the stakes that we're playing for here. It's absolutely vital. It's absolutely important. I thank you for listening to me, and I hand over to the chair.
All right. I've got a couple quick questions, and then I've got Representative Hertaus, Hillstrom, and Erdahl. Just going back to just a couple of slides. Was there another person over there? Marquardt and Carlson. Okay. Going back a bit, the state local tax burdens per capita as a percentage of income, North Dakota was listed as the highest. Now, that seems odd to me. I'm guessing that's because of excise taxes on oil being high divided by a fairly small population.
It would be, yeah.
All right. Okay. And then if I turn to the next page, and you've got the net flow of taxpayers and dependents by age, I mean, they're all going down. I mean, we've got underneath this, you're basically saying all age groups, if you look at the net level of people migrating, I guess, out of Minnesota versus migrating in, every age group is got net migration out. But our population is going up. I assume that's just because of the birth rate. Is that?
Well, there's different things, because this is tracking people, domestic migration around the U.S., so that's people from state to state. There are several elements to a population growth equation that this does not account for. So it doesn't account for, say, immigration from outside the United States. And as you say again, the birth rate or the excess of births over deaths is not accounted for in this either.
Okay, so that's one question I had. This doesn't include international immigration.
No.
This is only going state to state.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Representative Hertaus.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, the Center, for the presentation. I obtained a copy of your report last week and was able to read through it all. My question is regarding two graphs, and if you could comment if there is any correlation. One is a line graph in about the center, which is Minnesota's real GDP divided by the population and employed relative to the U.S. And I was looking at the pie chart, which bothers me regarding the sources of growth of real per capita income. Is there a correlation between what I perceive as a lower than what should be labor income and the GDP represented on that line graph? Is there any correlation there?
Mr. Phelan.
It's possible that they are linked. The main thing with the GDP by population per worker thing is, and we do fairly well on wages, it shows here. And when we look at the personal income data and break it down by component, you know, there are some areas where we lead and some where we don't, the national rate. But if you look at the pie chart, what that shows you, and the bar chart, I think, that's a little after it, is that shows you where these things have been moving. So some of these advantages that we have over the national rate in terms of, so for starters, our national advantage in terms of labour income, capital income is eroding. And our advantage or disadvantage in terms of transfer income, a negative number that because we were below the US average on that, that's moving up, so actually getting closer to that.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up, many of us baby boomers have read that there's 10,000 of us retiring every day in the nation. I would assume that trend is true in Minnesota as well. And are we growing enough to see the pie chart be stable or changing, or are we going to see transfer income continue to grow over the next 10, 12 years?
Well, there's a couple of things there. The first thing I'd answer is perhaps the second point you made about transfer incomes growing. This is a big issue. It's perhaps bigger than this setting, perhaps. It's a national-level issue. If you look at the Congressional Budget Office forecasts for U.S. government spending, they're horrific. You know, these numbers that just skyrocket. You know, and that is very largely a function of various Social Security payments that are projected to be paid out to baby boomers. So that's going to be a problem. And you'll see that at the nationwide level. You'll see it at the state level as well. But another point I make is that there are advantages. I mean, there are inbuilt strengths in Minnesota that we have. We have a high degree of social capital, for example. And one aspect of that is you're hardworking people, you know. So when you talk about, they talk about baby boomers dropping out of the workforce, our labor force participation rate actually ticked up slightly recently. And I actually think that you'll probably have older Minnesotans working more than you would, say, necessarily older people in other states. Because I think you have, and this is where I start to move into the sort of slightly woolier areas of economics, is into the field of social capital. You have a conservative way of life here. For a blue state, a liberal state, and I say this as an outsider, you have a very conservative way of life. You have high rates of marriages. You have, you know, good rates of families staying together. And you have people working hard and, you know, starting jobs and staying in them. And that is really, that's social capital. I mean, it can go. It can be squandered like all capital can be. But it's absolutely, that's the source of your strength at the moment. And what I think you've just talked about there, it will stand you in better stead going forward than some other states will find themselves in.
But John, can I just add one thing to that, and that is to kind of come around to where the question started. There is no doubt that it is a problem that many people are leaving the labor force and are going to have to be supported, you know. And the only way we're going to be able to do that successfully is with high productivity, high skill, high income, high value jobs. We've got to get those high value, high productivity jobs, a lot more of them, so that we've got the wherewithal to care for that aging population.
Yeah, I mean, if I go back to this chart here, this one. What we need to see really is more jobs at that, you know, that end of the scale rather than that end. So one of the things that you have there is mining and logging. You know, you have a situation in the north of the state as regards mining where that's somewhere that you could have positive growth effects. You know, if you got behind mining up there, you would have more jobs, and they're very high GVA per job. So you would have these high-earning productivity jobs that would enable you to support, a lower labour force participation rate. So that's actually, you know, a fantastic real-world example of some of these lines and all the rest you see on these charts.
Okay, I'm going to go to Representative Hillstrom, but let me just first say I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to get to everyone that wants to be on the list for this and still be able to also get the other things we've got on our agenda. But Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have it's really three pieces that are kind of all interconnected. So the portion of household by numbers of workers in 2015, you referenced that slide, and you say that we have the households with no workers. Do you take into account how many of those are based on retirement? So they've worked their entire career, they've now got a pension, they're not retired. So is that these households with no workers included?
Mr. Bulan.
So, there might be an element of that. The data doesn't allow us to kind of drill down into that. But again, I mean, that would tie into what we just talked about there, in the sense that, we still lag the national average. So it'd be interesting to add what our age profile's like. Just as a rough thing, and I've got no numbers that back this up, but if you assume that this is the sort of place that older people tend to leave, then you might perhaps expect our age profile to be a bit lower than other states, so that would perhaps be part of it.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I was actually going to take that to the next slide as well, the source of growth per capita income component of income 2000 to 2016, the transfer income as well with 47%. I wanted to know if you took into account the age on that. And so because you said on the other one you didn't, I assume that this one didn't as well. But my biggest concern is that high productivity doesn't necessarily mean high income or high wages. And we have a lot of people who work. Our unemployment numbers are very low. And so when you have low unemployment numbers, you can't have a lot of job growth because you don't have a lot of people to work. And so just because you have people working doesn't, and they may be producing at the highest rate that they can, you can't continue to grow an economy if you don't have workers to work there. So that would be the one last thing that I would say. If you want to grow the GDP, that doesn't necessarily mean that you grow wages for workers.
If I may respond to that, I would think slightly differently on that. For example, I mean, if you look at there's academic papers that show this, and they show you the growth rates of those three sums in the growth equation. And if you countries that had most of their growth came from an increase in the labour force, their growth rate was low. Countries where it was came from a growth rate in their capital stock per worker, their growth rate was a bit higher. But when you looked at the component of growth, and you can work this out through growth accounting, that comes from total factor productivity increases, then in that case, you know, the growth is a lot higher. So really, the essence of growth is higher wages, higher productivity. And we do see that. And one thing, if you look at the state of Minnesota specifically, actually, we do have a very tight labor market now. We have the high labor force participation rate. We have the low unemployment rate. And we actually now start to see wages rising the last couple of years, you know. And it's difficult because, you know, the last few years people here have been saying wages are stagnant, it's terrible, we must raise the minimum wage. And that apparently was a huge crisis. But now that wages are rising, people say, oh, no, it's terrible, wages are rising, you know, how are we going to keep growing? You can't square the two, I would argue. You know, I mean, the essence of economic growth is increased per capita incomes, per capita productivity, and per capita wealth. It's not necessarily just growing the populations. And in fact, if you look at countries with fast population growth, they're generally countries with low economic growth.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Phelan. I'm wondering what you think is the most important thing that we can do in Minnesota to maintain or increase the productivity of our workforce, which apparently is a very vital area of your report. I'll just give you a little more background. You know, a few years ago, when Representative Marquardt was chair of the Education Committee, we have the world's best workforce, where we put in things like reading attainment by third grade, a goal of high graduation rates and things like that, which I think would be certainly two important elements among others. And then another concern I have, and wonder how you would react to this. Over the years in education in Minnesota, we have emphasized four-year academic degrees and kind of slipped away from vocational, which maybe we are returning to a little bit, but if you see any correlation between the need in productivity and academics versus vocational.
There's a few things to say there. To try and work through in the order that you spoke about them. Things that we could do to increase productivity. Like I say, if you think about capital per worker, where our workers are undercapitalized compared to the national average. So you'd want to look at things that would stimulate that. And like I say, there is academic evidence that suggests that these things are driven by tax rates. So I would look at ways that you can make your taxes more conducive to that kind of investment. Another thing is regulation. And where you have regulations that are getting in the way of the creation of these sorts of high productivity, high paying jobs. So again, I go back to the example of mining in the north of Minnesota. There would seem to be, bills on the sidewalk there, which are being stepped over a little bit at the moment because of this regulatory clampdown on any kind of mining activity up there. You talked a little bit about education. And again, as you say, that's absolutely vital. That's a huge contribute to human capital. And what you have to do is think, I don't want to get into a debate about what's the purpose of education, because it's several things. But one thing that you should absolutely never lose sight of is that you send your kids to school to learn to read and write and add up, not to necessarily feel guilty about various things or get into all these other things. And you've got to keep absolute sight that, from an economic perspective, you've got to maintain that focus. There'd be a saying in England, the three R's, reading, writing, arithmetic. I don't know if you have that here. But that's, absolutely kind of key, I think, in terms of an educational focus. And the last thing about the four-year degrees, I think that's absolutely true. We have projects running at the centre, great jobs with that four-year degree, what we're trying to do is to show to people, and trying to publicise to people that, you don't need to go off and necessarily run up a huge debt doing a liberal arts degree or something like that for 4 years. I mean, some people do it, it's great. But there are good jobs to be had out there that come at the end of 2-year vocational training courses and things like that, which for a relatively low investment up front, you get a much higher kind of lifetime income payoff. And we actually have, we haven't got copies of it, we do have reports on our website where we had somebody estimate, the lifetime incomes, the benefits of that if you went and became, say, a welder rather than if you went off to college for 4 years. But I think that's a huge part of it, you know. I mean, being British, you know, you kind of often envy the Germans for various things. And one of the things that they did used to have was this absolutely wonderful system of vocational training in highly skilled work. I remember hearing a story once in Germany. A young boy, he got offered a contract for a leading football club, and that wasn't reported in the newspapers. They reported this guy who'd been given a training contract at one of the metals companies. You know, that shows really where their kind of priorities lay in terms of the culture of growth.
Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask questions on productivity in the same line as Representative Birdall. In the sake of time to hear the other testifiers, I'll pass.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, maybe we can ask questions. I also want to hear from the next testifier, so I think I'll hold my comments and questions until perhaps after the second testifier is done.
All right. Okay.
If I can remain on the list.
Sure. Well, so do you want to remain on the list for the next group, Representative Marquardt? No? Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Well, Mr. Hinderacher, Mr. Phelan, thank you very much. You know, there may be some other questions later after we have the second group come up, so if you can stick around, that'd be great.
Thank you.
All right. If I could have Jeff Van Wyken of the North Star Policy Institute come forward.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Katie Hatt. I am the Executive Director at the North Star Policy Institute. We thank you for the opportunity to share a contrasting view of Minnesota's economy this morning. And with us to give that presentation, Mr. Kennedy had asked us to take about 10 minutes, is our Fiscal Policy Fellow, Jeff Van Wyken. So I'll turn it over to Jeff.
Mr. Van Wyken, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. And for the record, my name is Jeff Van Wyken. I'm the Fiscal Policy Fellow with the North Star Policy Institute. We're going to look at a variety of economic indicators that show that Minnesota has actually done quite well in recent years relative to other states. It's important to examine a time frame that's not arbitrary, but it's tied to the business cycle. The business cycle refers to the period of recession followed by the subsequent recovery. Our current business cycle began with the start of the Great Recession in 2007 and will end at the beginning of the next recession, whenever that is. Our current business cycle began... So the time frame we'll examine will start with December 2007, or as close to that time as we can get, and end at the most current period for which we have data. It's important to approximate a full business cycle to get a meaningful long-term perspective of the performance of one state relative to another or relative to the national average. For example, a state that had steep job loss relative to the national average during the recession can be expected to have above-average job gains during the subsequent recovery because it has more unemployed and underemployed workers to draw from. The above-average growth in this state during the recovery is not a signal of superior long-term economic performance, but rather a function of the greater job losses during the recession. For this reason, we try to examine the full business cycle to the extent possible. So this is not an arbitrary date. If we were to choose 2000 or 2005, that would be arbitrary. This is one driven by the business cycle. Now, it's we already had some discussion of convergence, so there's apparently some disagreement because the economists I'm familiar with think that convergence still does occur. But even if it doesn't, Minnesota has still been largely successful in bucking the convergence trend, as we'll see. Consider the first graph in our handout here. I'm sorry it's black and white. It's much prettier in color. If anyone wants a color copy, we'd be happy to get it to you. At the beginning of the Great Recession, Minnesota's per capita GDP was 4.5% above the national average. Since then, Minnesota's real GDP has grown by over 14%, significantly higher than the national average. In these graphs, we also compare Minnesota to Wisconsin and to other Midwest states, by which we mean the 12 Midwest states as defined by the Census Bureau, excluding Minnesota. Because the Midwest average is dragged down by poor performance in Rust Belt states, we examine the Midwest excluding these Rust Belt states. In a nutshell, Minnesota has surpassed each of these areas in GDP growth and is currently about 7% above the national average in per capita GDP. Like the rest of the Midwest, Minnesota has lost population to other states as baby boomers retire in search of warmer climes and other factors. This trend has suppressed population growth in the Midwest relative to the U.S. average, as we see in the second graph. However, in terms of population growth, Minnesota has done much better than its neighbors, with a rate of population growth near the national average and more than double that of Wisconsin and the rest of the Midwest. In fact, we had some earlier testimony about the fact that we're losing tax filers. Based upon the most current IRS statistics of income migration, Minnesota's loss of tax filers from 2015 to 2016 is minuscule. In fact, in 2017, Minnesota was one of only two Midwest states to have a net population gain from migration from other states. On the second page, we turn to labor force and job growth. On both of these, growth in Minnesota has been greater than the national average and greater than in Wisconsin and the rest of the Midwest. Minnesota's growth has been particularly strong over the last year or so. In the final graph, we look at growth in average hourly earnings. We did not look at productivity. To tell the truth, Mr. Chair, I began putting this presentation together on Friday. I did not have time to look at productivity, which our previous testifier said is a slippery concept. Anyways, we focused on something that's more easily measurable, and that's average hourly earnings. The numbers in these graphs are nominal, so they're not adjusted for inflation. In 2007, hourly earnings for working people in Minnesota were about $2 above the national average. Wisconsin was about 50 cents below the national average. From 2007 to 2015, growth in earnings lagged the national average in both Minnesota and Wisconsin. In the last 2 years, earnings in Minnesota grew more rapidly than in Wisconsin, and we caught up to the national average in terms of the growth rate. So by 2017, average hourly earnings in Minnesota were back to $2 above the national average, while Wisconsin fell to $1.50 below the national average. And as someone who's worked a variety of jobs, for the typical worker, the issue is not productivity. The typical worker is interested in making a living. And in Minnesota, our wages are higher. We are making a better living. Looking at other measures, Minnesota meets or surpasses the national average in personal income and median household income growth, which is an accomplishment given that Minnesota started out ahead of the national average, so we've, to the extent there is convergence, we've managed to overcome the trend. Minnesota enjoys a very low unemployment rate, as does Wisconsin. In both states, the unemployment rate fell from about 5% at the beginning of the recession to about 3% today, well below the U.S. average. However, the path that each state took in reducing its unemployment rate is quite different. The unemployment rate drops when employment growth exceeds labor force growth. And Minnesota had labor force growth well above the national average, but it also had more robust job growth, so the unemployment rate fell. Wisconsin, meanwhile, had below average job growth, but it had an even lower labor force growth, so its unemployment rate also fell, but for a very different reason. In short, Minnesota achieved an unemployment rate reduction through above-average job growth, while Wisconsin achieved its with below-average growth. Now, I'm not saying that Minnesota has no economic problems. All states do. But we're doing well relative to the national average and better than the Midwest in general on most indicators. During the current business cycle, Minnesota matched the national average in wage growth, despite the fact that we were above the national average to begin with. We surpassed the national and regional averages in job, labor force, GDP, and income growth. In terms of population growth, we're modestly below the national average, but well above the regional average. While we can't be complacent, Minnesota's economy is doing well relative to other states, especially other Midwest states. And just briefly, Mr. Chair, it's certainly true that Minnesota's performance wanes if we look at a longer time frame, going back to 2000. However, from 2000 to 2007, Minnesota was among the leaders in the nation in cutting per capita taxes. We were either fourth or fifth in terms of the decline in real per capita taxes, own source revenue, total revenue, and total expenditures. To the extent we were underperforming the national average in those years, we can't necessarily blame it on high taxes because we were cutting taxes in those years. Before I conclude, Mr. Chair, there was just a few observations that made previously that I would like to address. We were told that Minnesota personal income growth is driven largely by government transfer payments. That's certainly not the case during the current business cycle. Minnesota not only surpasses the national average in personal income growth, but the share of that growth coming from government transfers is smaller than the national average. And regarding the comparison of the Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan statistical area to other statistical areas, I would note that in terms of population, Minnesota, this MSA, Minneapolis-St. Paul, is not among the 15 largest MSAs in terms of population. If you compare us to MSAs of a comparable size, we've actually done quite well, and we've done much better than other Midwest MSAs of a larger or comparable size. And it was argued that our higher median income is due to the fact that we have more workers per household, but let's not forget that Minnesota's economy provides jobs that pay 8% more than the national average. That's probably a more important reason for our high median income growth. And finally, we had a chart showing the Minnesota state and local taxes per capita. I would note that taxes per capita are not a particularly good way to measure the tax burden. That's because high per capita income states, like Minnesota, almost always have higher taxes per capita because we get less from the federal government. We have higher wages that we have to pay. Our revenue department has done an analysis of this, and they found a very strong correlation between per capita income and per capita taxes, with the high per capita tax state, high per capita income states almost always having higher per capita taxes. A better measure of the relative size of government among states would be to look at total revenue, not just taxes, or total expenditures as a percentage of personal income. That's what the Revenue Department does. That's what the U.S. Census Bureau does. And when you use that measure, Minnesota falls about in the middle of the pack. So with that, Mr. Chair, I thank you very much for your time. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Van Wyken. I have Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, my comments are actually more for the first testifier, so I think I'll wait until if there are questions of the current testifier.
All right. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, either one, I guess one of the things that came up in the previous conversation was the idea of capital formation. And I'm wondering if you've done any study relative to that.
Mr. Chair, I'm not an economist. I only play one before the Ways and Means Committee. And so, no, I have not.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, what I noticed was that in one of their charts that the revenue growth, per capita revenue growth, has gone down actually by 23% in the area of capital revenue growth. In other words, that would be things that money that people are making on their savings or investing in business. And the other thing that really concerns me is that the venture capital, the difference between the U.S. average back in 07, which was the start of the recession, was about $75 between 100 and 175, whereas when we get out to 2015, it was $100 for us compared to $400 nationally. And I'm wondering if that's something that would be of concern as well, from the standpoint that if we don't formulate capital in this state that would support capital investments to make productivity higher, if that's something that might influence these numbers in the future. Because looking back is great, but looking forward is really what our charge is.
Ben Wyken.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, you are getting in over my head, I have to be honest. So I have not looked at all at capital formation. I can't critique the information that came before, or nor do I have a reply to it at this point.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm like Representative Carlson. I have more questions for the previous.
Oh, all right. Okay. Okay, well, maybe we can have Mr. Hinderacher and Mr. Phelan come back up then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
I guess, Mr. Hinderacher, Mr. Phelan, do you have anything else you want to say at this time? If you do, please go ahead. Otherwise, we'll take questions from Mr. Representative Carlson and Representative Anderson.
Mr. Phelan has got a couple of things he'd like to add, and I may also, when he's done, have a couple of things to a couple of comments in response to the last presentation, as well as some recommendations about how Minnesota's economy can do better.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Phelan.
Yeah, the first thing first point I make is about where you start with this data. And there was a point made about business cycles, and that's why that was chosen rather than some other date. It's worth noting that if you go back to 2000, of course, there was a recession in 2000-2001. So our period of time actually covers two business cycles. What was known as the dot-com crash and then the recession, and then you have another bubble and bust. So we do the same thing. We just go back further. And the second point to make is that it was said that productivity is a slippery thing, and apparently I had said that. No, I didn't. I said total factor productivity is a slippery thing. That's a different thing from productivity, which is GDP per worker or per hour worked. So I think it's important to clarify that these phrases mean things, and you have to be quite precise about what you mean. You know, it's one of the first things they teach you, you know, when you do economics is, you know, you've got to be these words have precise meanings, and you have to know them because total factor productivity and per worker productivity, the different things.
I want to talk for just a moment about cherry picking. Can we bring those two graphs up, please, John? The charts that the North Star people presented don't contradict our data, don't contradict our report, with this possible arguable exception. Now, this is the chart that they presented, and they chose to start at GDP growth in 2007. And they use the excuse that, though, that has to do with timing of recessions. And that's the place where if you start it there, you can have the Minnesota line a little bit above the U.S. line and say, aha, we've done better than average. But this quarterly data set doesn't start in 2007. It starts in 2005. So if you simply take the whole data set, 2005 to the present, what do you see? What you see is that Minnesota lags the country with respect to GDP growth. We're the blue line. We are below average if you use the whole data set. The only way you get us above average is if you cherry-pick the starting point. Now, if you take the long data set, which we do in our report that starts in 2000, what do you see? You see that if you measure the 21st century, the state of Minnesota lags the U.S. in GDP growth. The only way you can come to a different conclusion is by cherry-picking the starting point of the graph. I found some of the things that were said here a little bit puzzling. We rated job growth and GDP growth in the Twin Cities metropolitan statistical area against the top 15 by GDP statistical areas in the country, and it was suggested that that is inappropriate because the Twin Cities are not one of the top 15 MSAs. True, we're number 16, okay? We are number 16 in population. We do make the top 15 in terms of GDP. And if you look at the cities that we're being compared to in those charts, these are the cities that the Twin Cities are competing with for jobs, for businesses, for residents, for economic growth. These cities are competing with us. They're competing hard with us. They are trying to attract our businesses, and they are doing it very, very successfully. And the suggestion that we shouldn't pay attention to that because we're only number 16 seems to me to be not well taken. And finally, I think I heard the comment made that wages in Minnesota are 8% higher than the national average. I'm not sure I caught that exactly correct, but it certainly isn't true. We have a chart on that. It is true that weekly earnings in Minnesota are slightly higher than weekly earnings for the United States generally, and that's been true for a considerable length of time, but it's nothing like 8%. It's a very slight advantage. So what I want to do to wrap up here is just to point out some things about which there is not really any serious dispute. There's no real debate in the data. It is undeniable that in the 21st century, Minnesota's GDP growth has been slower than the national average. It is also undeniable that the average Minnesota worker is less productive than the average American worker. And you cannot sustain above-average incomes along with below average productivity. The numbers don't work. It can't be done. It is also undeniable that job growth in Minnesota has been concentrated in relatively low income and low GDP producing sectors with very little job growth, if any, in the more desirable job sectors. It's also undeniable that we have fewer companies starting up to do business in Minnesota than most other states. And most of all, we can argue about the data all we want, but the reality is that people are voting with their feet. And we brought along some copies of our 2016 income migration paper. Not a lot of them. Anybody else who'd like to get a copy of that paper certainly can get it. We're going to update it again this year. And what it shows is that people of all ages, we're not talking about snowbirds, we're not talking about retirees, it shows that people of all ages, we are suffering a net outflow of residents to other states. And it also shows that people of all income ranges, almost all income ranges, we suffer a net outflow of residents to other states. It's not just the rich leaving Minnesota. Household incomes, 0 to 25,000, we're a magnet. We net gain people in that lowest income category. But in every income category from $25,000 per household up, we are a net loser to other states. Now, the comment was made that the most recent IRS data show a very small loss of income and residents to other states. That's true, and that's why we didn't amend our income migration report in 2017. I think the speaker probably isn't aware why that's true. What happened in that year of IRS data is that it showed significantly reduced migration, not just in and out of Minnesota, but in and out of all states in the United States. It showed migration being down by about 30%. We scratched our head over that. Peter Nelson, then my vice president, called the guy at the IRS who does this and says, have you noticed that you guys have got migration down by 30%? And the guy at the IRS said, yeah, we're trying to figure it out. We don't know why that happened. We don't understand it. And so we didn't do anything with those numbers. But what those numbers showed was, yes, with that significant reduction in migration everywhere, the loss to Minnesota was smaller, but it was still a loss. So you really have to understand where these numbers come from, and you have to drill into the sources if you really want to get meaningful conclusions from them. I want to close with this. I grew up in South Dakota, and when I was growing up, ambitious young people in South Dakota came to Minnesota in search of opportunity. Today, that flow is running in the other direction. The IRS data show that it is ambitious young Minnesotans who are now going to South Dakota in search of job opportunities. If we are satisfied with that, we don't need to change a thing, because that is what our current policies are producing. If we're not satisfied with that, then I think we need to be talking about what Minnesota can do differently so that Minnesota can do better. Mm-hmm. And with the committee's permission, I'd like to set out very briefly what we think are three fundamental things that this state can do to improve its economy. Number one, we have to be more competitive with other states. Whether we like it or not, other states are competing with us for businesses and residents. We currently have the eighth highest personal tax burden in the U.S. and the third highest corporate income tax rates. If you're a corporation, it is more expensive to do business in Minnesota than almost any other place in the world. That's just unacceptable. Our 2016 report on income migration found that 8 of the 10 states to which we have the largest net loss of income are lower tax states, and 5 of those 10 states are states that don't have an income tax at all. So we need to restrain spending so that we can bring about significant tax reductions so that we can compete more effectively with other states. We've got a new report out just last week that John did on the Minnesota state tax. It recommends repeal of the estate tax, and it argues that we probably would lose little or no money and might even gain revenue if we repeal our estate tax. I would urge you to become familiar with that paper and to consider that policy. Second thing we could do to improve our economy is we need a much better match between job skills training and the needs of employers. We should emphasize technical education and job readiness rather than focusing so heavily on four-year college degrees. More and better technical education will go a long way toward making our labor force more productive, fundamental need, as we've been talking about, and toward making our businesses more successful. And third, we need to develop our mineral resources. We have hundreds of billions of dollars, maybe trillions of dollars, in non-ferrous mineral wealth in northern Minnesota that is going completely undeveloped. We have one of the largest deposits of non-ferrous mineral wealth anywhere in the world, and we're doing nothing with it. This is a simple way. If we can clear the government out of the way, if we can enable mining in northern Minnesota, this is a simple way that we can add significantly to our GDP, and we can add significantly to the high-wage, high-productivity jobs that we need for the future. With that, I'll stop and welcome any additional questions.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just a comment about the last comments. We had this report here before us today. I didn't think that the presenters were going to lead us into a political agenda that we just heard. I think that's a bit unfortunate because we were attempting to get at some of the facts relative to Minnesota's competitiveness, and that's why we had the two reports. So I think the political agenda probably should be for a different day rather than focusing on these reports. I have a couple of comments on the transfers. There was no comment about the demographics in Minnesota, but what comes to mind is the AARP report that one of the best states in the country to retire in, maybe even the best, is Minnesota. That was the AARP. So that would imply that a lot of Minnesotans are remaining here because it's a good place to retire in, and you mentioned some of those funds, Social Security and what have you, as leading the transfer question of economic growth. That's more a comment if you want to get to it later. You pointed to health care, and what came to my mind with that job growth, I view that as quite a positive. I mean, we've got two very major health care providers that are major employers in the state, not the least of which is Mayo, which I understand is our largest private employer in the entire state, and then United Health, which is a for-profit company that's housed here and also is a major employer. So I think I would footnote what you were talking about, where those jobs are growing, by pointing out our mix of industry, and we are very major in as a healthcare provider. And in both instances, they're providing services throughout the United States of America, but they're housed here and providing an awful lot of jobs in Minnesota. One thing that we, I think, perhaps do agree on is we do have a labor shortage in certain areas. And the previous chancellor of the Minsky system toured the state, talking to employers about what their needs were. And I think that's in part our very low unemployment rate, but we do need, and I would concur with your comments about perhaps technical education, we do need to do a better job of providing through MNSCU and our other higher education systems and probably some of the apprenticeship programs and so on that are operated by some of our state agencies of meeting that that shortage. And quite frankly, some of the places where that shortage is where you find it's cyclical. You know, what happens, our tech colleges will close certain programs because they're not employing carpenters or people in some of the other skilled trades. And then when the construction industry bounces back, they're not prepared to meet that demand. And when you look at where that demand is, and there was an article just the other day about we would have more housing being built if we had the skilled labor to be there to fill those jobs. So I think your comments there are probably an area where we would agree. Well, I'll just stop there in case there are others that have questions. But, one comment. I had the opportunity to attend, I think it was two or three meetings with some of the, this back when I chaired the Finance Committee, with some of the top CEOs in the metropolitan area. And they were very concerned about creating a positive image. Now, they were mainly from the Twin Cities, but out of that came the greater MSP. That was part of those early discussions, and they talked about the main competition being Denver. They talked about transit as being an important ingredient in terms of our economic growth in the metropolitan area. But these were major COs, and they wanted to create, as I understood it, and that's part of the role of that organization, a positive image for Minnesota. They were concerned about some of the negativism, quite frankly, as I understood some of their comments when I attended those meetings. So I don't know if you want to comment on anything I've said, but I don't. My first point was the transfers. I don't necessarily view that as a negative. That tells me that. And by the way, when I talk about demographics, Minnesota and Hawaii, longest life expectancy in the United States. That means our people are living longer, retired longer, and drawing those pensions perhaps longer, and those would be transfers. But that's probably just a subgroup within the transfers, so I'll stop there.
Can I say before, this real quick?
Mr. Hinderacher, before I take you, let me just announce, okay, we're at our regular adjournment time, and I'm going to run us on a little bit longer here, but we'll be definitely done by noon. I'm not going to be taking up Joel Michael today. We'll take him next week when we review the budget forecast as well. And then I have Representative Anderson, Hornstein, and Marquardt after Mr. Hinderacher. Mr. Hinderacher, do you want to respond? Or Mr. Phelan?
I'd just like to respond to the point about negativism. You know, being realistic and being negative are not necessarily the same thing. And I say this as somebody who moved 4,000 miles to come and live in this state. You know, it is a great place to live. It has a lot of wonderful advantages. It has great people. I could live without the weather sometimes. But, you know, I don't want you to think that I'm here or anybody here is you know, a council of despair. This is more what we hope is an early warning.
Mr. Those weren't my I was paraphrasing what some of the leading business leaders in the Twin Cities were concerned Indeed. About.
Okay.
So that's not me. That's some of the people that were at those meetings, and I don't want to name names, but they would be names that all of us in this room would recognize.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Phelan and Mr. Hinderacher. What I look at this data, and I do appreciate data, it does help us and guide us on where we need to go to make sure that we can afford the infrastructure that we have in this state, whether it's our schools, whether it's our roads, and everything else that we hold near and dear to our state. When I look at the data, what I'm most concerned about are the two charts on the net flow of taxpayers and dependents essentially leaving the state. We've talked about this wealth migration issue in tax committee before, and I'm looking at the chart from the IRS data where you've got folks in the higher income brackets clearly leaving the state, and then also just the age categories. That's really alarming to me quite a bit because I can see why Dr. Kalambakidis said that productivity is a major concern for us, because if you look at these age categories, clearly these are the people that are the highest earning potential and they're leaving our state. So, you know, these are the mid-level folks that are just not seeing our state as a place to be. And you know, I know that Minnesota always tends to make the list of Wall Street Journal's where not to die, which is not, you know, a great moniker to have for your state. But I'm more curious on the data that you have on the transfer data. You had talked earlier, Chair Knobloch had asked about what your different data, if it included immigration from outside of the United States. Does your 47% of the transfer data, does that also include people that are, is that accounting for people that come to Minnesota from outside of the United States that are maybe needing transfer services?
It would include that, but you couldn't break it down.
Okay, so we don't
so that,
know.
That is, yeah, so you could, I mean, it would include those people and whatever wages, capital income, transfer income they get, but you couldn't pick them out and investigate that separately. The data wouldn't sustain that.
Thank you.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I along the lines of both Representative Carlson and I think Representative Anderson hinted at this a little bit, I was surprised that in all of your conversation, you didn't talk about investments in public infrastructure. And the American Society of Civil Engineers gave Minnesota last year a D-plus rating in a whole range of infrastructure issues. You know, ports, we got a D. Roads, we got a D. Transit, a D-minus. Wastewater, a D-plus. The business community and many others have said to us that our economy and our ability to attract and retain businesses does depend on a strong public infrastructure. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that and the fact that Minnesota does not seem to be stacking up very well compared to our peers in other states in this area.
Great question.
Mr. Hinderocker.
Great question. This is why we did a big project last summer on highway congestion, street congestion, in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. We have a terrible, terrible congestion problem. And so we've argued strenuously for more investment directed specifically at relieving congestion, specifically at relieving the roadblocks that we've got. Some of the most famous bottlenecks in the United States are located right here in the Twin Cities. And we've recommended a focus in our transportation funding on streets and highways and streets and highways that cars can drive on, not making them smaller for tiny numbers of bicyclists to use while the congestion increases for cars and drivers. So I think you're absolutely right about infrastructure. We've written about that. We intend to return to that topic again in 2018, and I think that's a very tangible area where we could make ourselves more attractive to businesses and residents from other states.
To be continued.
I think part of it is there's certain policies, obviously, but I think we're grossly underfunding our infrastructure, particularly roads, bridges, transit, wastewater, et cetera.
Representative Mark Bork.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing these groups. I think this was good, and I think there was some good information to take back home from both presentations. And, Mr. Phelan, I did like your emphasis on production, and Representative Erdahl got to that too, and you know, I think, you know, we could talk even more about, you know, education and infrastructure and, you know, rural broadband and those sorts of things, because we know our job force is slowing down.
Yeah.
And so the only way you're going to get more productivity isn't more workers, it's going to be better output from each and every worker. And you know, the way Minnesota's population trends are going, a lot of new folks are coming in internationally. And so it's crucial that we deal with an achievement gap. That is going to be crucial. And as Representative Erdahl mentioned back in education, we had folks that would talk about if you could close the achievement gap, it would improve our GDP by 2 to 3%, which is significant. So thank you for that. The one point I also had to comment on were maybe some of the conclusions. And, you know, we're here to debate, you know, how much taxes impact our business climate, how much infrastructure and so forth. And you can look at different ratings. If you look at ratings that are going to focus just on taxes, Minnesota tends to score lower. And if you look at other factors when they take taxes but put them in with workforce quality and health care and quality of life, we do better. And I guess that's what we decide here is what is a mix of those things. So I would disagree that to put all of your eggs into the tax basket isn't correct, because we know there's so many different factors that influence your business climate. And you can look at ratings and so forth. You know, Governing Magazine just came out January 2018 with a list of on job growth, and Minnesota ranked 12th. We had like 48,000 new jobs, which total surpassed almost our neighboring four states. And, you know, our unemployment rate is, what, 3.1%, which ranks a 10th. Do taxes make a difference? Absolutely. Yeah, they make a difference. But that's kind of for us to decide, and that's why we have all this great debate in tax committee and ways and means is what percent that does entail. I'll just give you one stat, is that when Minnesota had net migration gain from 1991 to 2001, and that was both domestic and international, our top individual rate was 8.5%. It started to go down, actually, in 2001, to now when we actually had lowered our top rate to 7.85%. So I'm not saying that you raise taxes and you know things go the other way. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying there's a lot of different factors that start to affect these migration rates one way or the other. Taxes, we certainly, you know, we've got some headline taxes that, you know, there's a report that was just put out by House Research talking about our corporate rate is the third highest in the nation, 9.8%. And for people who don't look beyond that, that's out there, and I recognize that. But I just think as we debate everything, we just have to make sure and look at the strengths in this cold weather state, why we do really pretty well, especially to our neighbors, and it's our workforce and education and so forth. So I do appreciate the – I think this is always good to have these thoughts. So thank you.
You know, I think with us running up to the noon hour here, I think maybe now is a good time for us to close this off. So I want to thank all the testifiers today and members. Next week, well, the budget forecast is coming out on Wednesday the 28th. Our hearing next week will be on the budget